The Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicasterJane.com. Welcome to the Helicaster Jane Show. I am your host, Helicaster Jane. Let's talk. Here we are in the throes of a contentious political season. The mud is slinging, nerves on edge, and I thought it was time to introduce a little spirituality into the conversation. I do just that with my guest, beloved spiritual teacher and author, Mary Ann Williamson, here to talk about her new book, Tears to Triumph, and about what else? Politics. That's just the beginning of the show. In our second half hour, it's our saucy, sassy, smart panel, Four Broads Talking, with Sheila Weller, Lisa Schifrin, Susanna Andrews, and me, bringing up the rear. So stay tuned. But before we begin, the Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by our new partner, Kobo, for all your e-reading services. And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com. Does internationally acclaimed author and lecturer Mary Ann Williamson really need an introduction? 6 of her 10 published books have been New York Times bestsellers. Her books include A Return to Love, A Year of Miracles, The Law of Divine Compensation, The Gift of Change. Mary Ann has been a popular guest on television programs such as Oprah, Good Morning America, and Charlie Rose. In her new book, Tears to Triumph, The Spiritual Journey from Suffering to Enlightenment, the renowned spiritual teacher offers an impassioned spiritual perspective on the epidemic of depression sweeping our society and joins a growing chorus of voices addressing the over-medication of America. Let's talk. Okay, Marian, let's just get right to it. What's your definition of suffering?
Well, it's interesting. The definition of suffering is kind of like a definition of love. It's not so much that you can define it as you simply know when it's present and you know when it's not. I know when I suffer, when I'm in pain, when I'm sad. I don't need to define it. I feel it. And I know when those around me are suffering if I am sensitive to it.
You know, it's interesting to me. What a world, right? Why is suffering a part of the human experience? I mean, really, why must we suffer?
We suffer because the consciousness of the human race is dominated by a thought system that repudiates who we are. We are spiritual beings. We are not bodies. And yet the thought system that dominates this world tells us that we are bodies and that we are separate from each other rather than one with each other, which we know when we realize we are spirits rather than bodies. The world tells us that we live in a world of scarcity. Therefore, we come to feel that we need to compete with each other more than collaborate with each other, which is the only path to abundance. We're taught that because we're only bodies rather than spirits, that we only live according to this one little mortal stretch of existence as opposed to eternally. So the world in which we live breeds fear, and the consciousness of our culture actually breeds depression. You know, we are taught that you have to figure out what would make you happy and go for it. Well, Buddha said that the things of this world can only bring temporary happiness. So we're always struggling. You know, people are grasping and struggling to get this or get that, because once I get that, then I'll be happy. But since, as Buddha said, the things of this world are never deep enough to sustain us. So even if you get it, you'll be in despair until you get it. Then even if you get it, ultimately, if it's an external thing, the fairy dust is going to rub off. So then we're in despair, because even having gotten the things we thought would make us happy, that didn't do it. Because only the giving and the receiving of love and deep soulful relationship and community, that is the source of our happiness. So you take all of that and then you add to that the genuinely depressing things that are happening in our world today. Look what's happening. We've got police shootings and nobody knows what's going on with that. We've got out of control terrorism around the world. We've got climate change that threatens to implode the whole ecosystem if we don't change. If you're looking at the world today and you're not grieving, are you even looking?
Yeah, really.
So this is not the time to numb our pain. This is time for serious people to be very serious. It's a somber moment. And during a somber moment, it is appropriate to be somber. So whether it's our own individual lives where we need to ask ourselves some serious questions about what we're doing, about mistakes we've made, about choices, or whether it's our looking at the entire world, this is not a time to avoid our pain, but to realize that psychic pain, just like physical pain, conveys a message. And you have to heed the message and make the changes called upon. You can't just numb the pain.
I want to ask you this, Marianne. You know, you're a guru for so many people, and I think this is important to lay this out. You're a celebrity. You appear to have it all, but suffering is universal. You know that. You know of what you write. So explain that to people. You know, suffering does not get the poor and the, you know, whatever. It gets us all.
Well, I mean, that's all an illusion, that there's anything that we can have. You say I'm a quote-unquote celebrity. It's a man-made, it's an artificial construct. What? That means that if my, you know, they say a woman is as happy as her least happy child. So what? I have some books that I've sold, and so people know my name because I've been out there for a long time, and that's going to mean that I'm any less sad if my child is sad, or if I have a romantic breakup, or if, you know, I ran for Congress, I lost. I've made choices that made me lose money. I mean, I've been through my failures in life, personally and professionally, as much as anyone else. And the fact, you know, sometimes if you're in public and you fall on your face, it could be argued the pain is greater because you're humiliated on top of everything else.
Right. I hear you on that, and I totally agree with that. And And I'm so glad that you said the thing about celebrity, because that's, you know, you talk about this running. We're all running towards something we have to achieve.
Yeah, just another thing people think is going to maybe make them happy. But,
yeah, and that ain't so, folks. We can all tell you that. That's never going to be your answer for anything that you're going to do. So sad, depressed, medicated, so many in this society today. In your opinion, suffering on the rise, better diagnosed? Are people just more honest about how they truly feel? And if it is on the rise, I'd like to hear your opinion on why you believe that it is. Has this world gone mad?
Well, first of all, the world has gone mad. So the fact that people are depressed about it actually just shows that we are sensitive creatures. This does not mean there's something wrong with us. What you've got is the canaries in the coal mine falling over, and then the owner of the mine saying there is something wrong with the canaries. The fact that people are depressed today is because the world is depressing, because the way we are ordering our civilization is predicated on ideas that repudiate the truth of who we are. The fact that this makes us sad is one of the healthiest things that can be said about us. Sometimes your neurosis is more delineated by what doesn't make you sad than by what does. For instance, a sociopath has no remorse. A sociopath has no conscience. We don't want to be people who don't feel bad when we've made mistakes. You know, would we be better off today if the abolitionists just hadn't gotten so upset about it? Would we be better off today if Susan B. Anthony had just known how to chill and not create drama wherever she goes? I mean, this is what's called religiously in the Greek Orthodox tradition, the passion bearers. Passion bearers today, Paul Hawken has that expression, blessed unrest. The fact that our young people are upset about the inequity in our economic system, they're upset about the fact college is so expensive. They're upset about the climate being the way it is. They're upset about these police shootings. Darn right people are upset. We should be upset. This doesn't mean something's wrong with us. It means that there is something wrong with situations that we need to change. And if we didn't get upset about them, what would motivate us to make the change? One woman told me that she took a pill and it made her, she said, yes, it made me numb to my own sadness, but it also made me numb. She said, I had a cut on my finger and I kept looking, okay, it's okay. She said, finally, other people looked at it and said, you need to go to the hospital. And she was in big trouble. You know, she had a staph infection, et cetera, because she just hadn't been that upset about it.
That's kind of weird.
You know, it's like psychic pain, it's like physical pain. It conveys a message. If you have a broken leg, you can't just take morphine. Humanity would not have evolved over thousands and thousands of years without an internal immune system that enables us to absorb quite a bit of injury and disease. That's not only true physically, it's also true psychically. And that's what grief is. But now, if you're in a car accident and you have bruises on your body, it is understood it's going to take the bruises some time to heal. But that is no different emotionally. A woman said to me the other night, her husband died 3 months ago. She was in love with him. They'd been married for decades. They'd had children. It's been 3 months, and she said through her tears, I'm not handling it well. She's handling it perfectly. It is the most natural thing in the world that after 3 months, she's still crying.
Right.
When I was a child, it was understood, you know, there was this whole idea of a year People just kind of accept it. Society accepted it. Widows would wear black for a year. This was before we were all wearing black all the time. So we have bought into this idea that being sad is wrong.
Let's take that out a little bit further, because I think it is mm-hmm. important. It's one of the great points you make in the book. And that it seems that these days everyone is suffering. In fact, you said that emotional suffering isn't new. I think that's important to understand. That's just a part of who we are. But our failure to respond appropriately to the suffering, that is new. Talk to me.
Well, we have allowed a medical model to be imposed upon normal human despair. There is a spectrum of normal human suffering. And like you said, this has been going on for a long time. This is not new. Heartbreak is not some new disease that has been discovered. And this is crazy. You don't have a blood test for depression. You know, it's a questionnaire. And anybody who has looked at the questionnaire for depression, I defy anyone to say, I've never been through any of those symptoms. And who's to say how long is too long? If you have 45 tears to cry, then 13 of them is not enough. So when you look at our pain within a sacred context, and this is why I talk about the light of Buddha, I talk about the light of Moses, and I talk about the light of Jesus, and how all the great religious stories, all the great spiritual transmissions acknowledge human suffering, but lead us beyond it, whether you call it promised land or nirvana or resurrection or self-actualization or enlightenment or inner peace. So if I, let's say, had been through a deep heartbreak in a divorce, okay, a breakup, part of the pain is going to have to be, at some point, to look at my part. It's going to take me some time. I'm going to have to atone for my own mistakes and forgive the other person for theirs. If I do not do that, I will go forth bitter rather than better. You can't be happy if you see yourself as a victim. You can't be happy if you withhold forgiveness from those who have hurt you. You cannot be happy if you hold on to the past. You cannot be happy if you fail to atone and take responsibility for your own experience. So you can't just try to suppress the symptoms of depression. You can't just fight sickness. You have to cultivate health. And you can't just fight depression. You have to cultivate happiness. And we cultivate happiness by cultivating the thoughts that give rise to a happier emotion. Unforgiveness will keep you unhappy. Seeing yourself as a victim will keep you unhappy. And these things are not easy, and they take time. But this is the work that is necessary in order for us to transform our thoughts, that then transform our feelings, that then transform our lives. But it's a process.
Right.
And it takes time.
I think there's something important here, too, we ought to explore, and that is, you know, what is depression? Depress the feeling, which, you know, I could go down 15 rat holes in that sentence with you. But the one that I'm concerned with right now is the fact that if we do depress it, it does the exact opposite of what we wanted to do in the first place.
You better believe it. It burrows into your cells.
Yeah.
And it'll bite
that.
You later.
Right, right.
It'll bite you later. It will keep you from learning the lessons that you need to learn, so that when this situation has passed, you make different choices and live life from a different place. And if you don't go into the depth of that, and instead just try to seek to eradicate the symptom or suppress the pain, then you will not learn from it. And so later you're just going to reenact the same drama.
You know, maybe it's a part of the times. Are we too proud of people today that, you know, to admit to the world that I might be, or to my friends, or to my family, or to anybody, if we're going through one of these tough roads that we're in? Is it about pride? Is that something new? What is it about us, or maybe it's a human nature thing, that we don't want to share it, that we want to hide it, that we are embarrassed by it, when it is a basic human experience?
Well, this is interesting that you mention this, because one of the things I talk about in the book is how the traditional psychotherapeutic model that has been with us about 100 years or so has created an emphasis on the individual sufferer. Too many people think, I'm suffering and this is just about me, without realizing, no, you're suffering in the same way thousands of other people are suffering, and for some of the same reasons. And what happened is that people used to look to religion and spirituality for inspiration and comfort. And partly because of the malfeasance and abdication of moral authority within organized religion, the baton was passed to psychotherapy. And now, because if psychotherapy does not contain a spiritual dimension, it fails to give deep comfort, the baton has been passed again to psychopharmacology. And so everybody thinks this is about my story, my circumstances, and my pill. will, as opposed to, wait, this is something that is part of the universal condition. Buddha had some things to say about this. Jesus had some things to say about this. The story of Exodus has some things to say about this. Because, and you can look at these things in secular terms too. It's the hero's journey. You know, whether you see it in secular or religious spiritual terms, it's about learning how to forgive, learning how to have mercy, learning to receive the miracles that happen in our lives when we do come into any moment without condemnation of ourselves or others, with a faith in a wellspring of infinite possibilities that lies beyond this veil of illusion and veil of tears that it produces. Without learning spiritual intelligence, we do not have the tools by which to navigate the difficult times in life. And if you don't know how to navigate the difficult times in life, you don't know how to navigate life. And it infantilizes us to see it as just, oh, I have a disorder, I have a disease. This immediately turns you into a victim. And too many people are being told not only to take this pill, but to quote unquote expect to be on these for the rest of your life.
Let's really get into these pills, because this really is something we see this all of the time now, whether you're a kid and you're in school or you're, you know, a senior citizen. Let's just give everybody the pill, and that pill is going to be magic and life is going to be terrific. Now,
let me tell you something. It doesn't make life terrific.
Right.
It makes people docile. Mm. They are even giving now these pills to children in the foster care system so they won't be problematical. That is institutionalized child abuse.
Well, I happen to have rescued a foster kid out of foster care who, when I met her, was so zombied out she couldn't even speak. So I know of what you speak. I am so glad you brought that up. Keep going. Sorry, I had to interject that.
Well, it's just what you're saying.
Yeah.
They're giving, some states are giving children preventative
right,
meds.
Right. Right.
Because they might act out. It's like we have pathologized adolescence. We have pathologized childhood. Somebody was telling me the other day, her brother and sister-in-law have all four of their teenagers on anti-anxiety meds. I read about a 13-year-old on Wellbutrin. And this is not just these anecdotal things.
No,
this is a huge phenomenon in our society. And I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to talk to you about it, to know other women are upset about it too. Because as mothers, we really need to be crying foul here.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they tried to do it to, I'll tell you, a family member of mine, a kid, you know, give the damn pill. And the problem is that I think, and I want to say this because you sort of said it, I want to really, you know, scream it. You don't just turn off bad emotions, you turn off good emotions. You make zombies of human beings when you just medicate them. Yes?
How convenient that is.
Right.
I mean, that is horrifying. I mean, that's really how to just turn the country into a kind of, that's a path to fascism, because that's a path to a situation in which people just wouldn't have a problem with terrible things, you know? Like, would we be better off if the abolitionists had not been upset? Would we be better off if Susan B. Anthony had just known how to chill? We need to be crying foul about some things, and this is a terribly dangerous path to be taking, where everybody's just kind of numbing themselves and creating this kind of artificial chill.
Right. And one of the things that in society right now is that everything is so sped up. You know that. I know that. It's just, everybody's going a mile a minute. There's no time for anything real anymore. You know, we're just passing through each little thing that we do in our life. What happens, I think, with this pharmaceutical thing is, and I think it is something we can talk about, they give it. And the parents and educators, yeah, give the pill, because it's easier than dealing with what really needs to be dealt with. Bet you have something to say about that.
Yeah, well, it's things that need to be dealt with in the child,
right,
but also things that need to be dealt with in our society.
Right.
Because you can understand why these kids are unhappy. These young people who, they don't know how they're going to be able to afford college. They don't know if there's even going to be an environment for them to breathe in or bring children into within 20 years. They see rampant terrorism. They see rampant violence. They see the violence coming back to them from the TV, from the video games, from the television. How could we not be depressed? They're taught, you know, that they're going to have to grasp and struggle to get into that college, to get that job. You know, I don't know if you've seen Michael Moore's movie, Where to Invade Next.
Mm-mm.
But it's a really great movie. It's not what it sounds like it's about. I think it's a poor title because it sounds like military. And it's not. It's about all these things that they do in Europe countries. And one of the things that really impacted me was years ago, Finland, the country of Finland, found itself at the bottom in terms of education, and they decided to turn that around. They are now number one. And you know what? Their kids don't even have homework.
That's
they have the shortest hours. And when Michael Moore then interviews like the principals and the teachers, they go, well, if they had too much homework, when would they form relationships? When would they play? When would they experience nature? Like, hello. And they are now number one in education because these kids, when they're in school, are really excited about being there.
Right, right, right. I so agree with that whole model.
So no wonder these kids are depressed and anxious.
They're not getting out. They're not being, right. They're not being kids. That's part of it.
They're not being kids.
They're not being kids.
Not being taught, you know, a lot of what the schools now are doing because they're worried about negative socialization. They are actually just cutting out socialization. My daughter was at a school once, and I took her out of that school after that year, where the kids were not allowed to talk in between classes. They cut out recess.
Right.
And I said, you know, I'm a grown-up, and I work all day, and sometimes I just need a break.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if you're going to, and they said, well, we don't want the kids talking because we don't want negative socialization. But if you don't teach positive socialization,
then what do you do?
The answer is not to just suppress socialization. The answer is to teach positive socialization. I mean, that's a lot more important than learning geography.
Yeah, no, what they'd rather do, like you said and I say, they give them the pill, shut up, don't give us any flack, and just do your work, and that's it, and goodbye, and good luck, and then they wonder why the world is half-cocked. Why is the world half-cocked, by the way? You know, I so value what you have to say. Talk to me about this. It's gone.
Well,
what is going on?
As I said before, the entire planet, from a spiritual perspective, is dominated by a thought system based on fear rather than love. So we are constantly bombarded with useless information. That's at its best, and at worst, information that so repudiates the truth of who we are. We have taken, and you know, I'm all for free market economy. That's a wonderful thing. The marketplace is a wonderful thing when you are filling an actual need that people have. That's when the marketplace is ethical. But we have taken short-term economic gain, and we have made it God to the point where we are creating artificial appetite, and it's just we put money before love in ways that are absolutely insane. And everybody is struggling under the stress of this. And among other things, that kind of mentality does not spread the wealth. That kind of mentality has increased the power of a very small group of economic forces, huge multinational corporations, and so forth. So we need to step back. This is time for serious people to be very serious, to rethink all this.
Yeah.
And as we do, you know, even as parents, turn off the TV. It doesn't have to be on all the time. You don't have to tell your kids that they can bring the cell phone to the dinner table. You don't. We don't parent enough, I think.
I think that's true.
Because if you wait till
yeah.
these kids are, you know, the eye-rolling years, it's going to be hard.
Yeah, no,
you
I
teach
think you
these things from the time children are young. This is the time that we talk to each other.
Here's
this
another one. Yeah, you know, you brought that up. I want to bring the internet up. You know, the internet is supposed to bring us all closer together. I'm beginning to think it's doing the exact opposite of that. There's a false world when you go on to that into that place. It's so odd. What do you think about that? Because that's another thing with kids today, not limiting this conversation with a screen rather than sending them out to play and get dirty and learn how to interact with the neighborhood kids. You have something on that?
Well, first of all, the internet is not going away. But secondly, the internet is either positive or negative, holy or unholy, depending on the consciousness with which we use it. There are many ways in which the internet is a wonderful thing. The information, there's nothing you can't Google and find out about. You can talk to people who are on the other side of the world. So in many ways, it's a profoundly good thing. But it obviously can be used for very negative purposes. Now, I was once at lunch, and the table next to me was in Houston, Texas, and the table next to me, there were around five adults and one baby, and the baby was so young, she was still in a high chair, and they had that child with a little screen. She was a baby, and she was looking at a little pink screen.
Right.
Now, this was the age where that child should be looking around the table, her little brain learning social cues, learning language, looking at people's faces. I thought to myself, why did you even have a child if you didn't want a parent? I thought to myself, this is so dangerous. dangerous that even at the age of a baby, instead of the proper brain development, which has to do with children looking around, seeing adults, seeing other people, how they relate to each other. So this is so dangerous.
Right.
This is so dangerous, and I think that it's more than past time for us to be really crying foul and knowing that all of us have to take responsibility and starting in our own lives and our own relationships and our own homes, doing what we can to repudiate such craziness and to change the story
right.
and to live differently.
I want to get back to suffering. I want to talk about this. In Tears of Triumph, one of the things that you say is once we acknowledge our pain, there might be another problem. We might not be asking ourselves the appropriate questions. I so loved that. Talk to me.
Well, the appropriate question, for instance, if my business failed or I lost money or a relationship broke up, sometimes the question is, what was my part? What was my part in this disaster? Because even if my part was only 10%, I have to really look at that 10% and change my thinking and atone for my own errors, commit to changing, commit to growing in that area, forgive other people. As I was saying before, you can't see yourself as a victim and be happy. You can't withhold forgiveness and be happy. So these times are painful often. It's painful looking at the demons that come out in the dark. You know, that's another thing. If I take a pill for sleeplessness. Sometimes you're awake all night when you're depressed for a reason.
Right.
Because there are things that you were able to shoo away during the day that you can't shoo away at night. You're going to have to look at that. You know,
right.
You did this or you did that.
Right.
And facing that. Sometimes we have to face, if only I hadn't done this, if only I hadn't done that. Of course it's painful. But that's how we become people who next time we're out there, we behave differently. And that's the call. The call is to become wiser. The call is to become better at navigating life. And that's the only way ultimately to be happy, to grow into the person that you're capable of being, to live a more ethical and morally responsible life where you are more responsible towards yourself, towards others. You rise to the occasion. And that's what's wrong with the world today. Too many people are shrinking from the glorious possibility of being real serious grown-ups.
Listen to me. You say that, and I think that's a very important point. But I want to ask you this. What about, there's no time that you feel more alone than when the world is being hard on you, you know, and you're in that sense of depression, if you will. And here's the thing. There are a lot of people who can't get to that space to call up their own inner strength to see them through. Now, I'm sure your answer will be spiritual in nature. Talk to me. Do you agree?
Well, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
It's not about calling up your own inner strength.
Right, right.
You're the problem. You're not the answer. Human will, human thinking devoid of its spiritual content is the problem. It's not the answer. So it's not about your own inner strength from a spiritual perspective. It's, dear God, please help me. Open my eyes to what I need to see. You know, if there is a God, he's not just with you in the happy days. If there is a God, he's with you in the sad days too. And that's where prayer comes in, and that's where meditation comes in. Dear God, help me at this time of my sorrow. You know, I was reading one of the Psalms yesterday. I loved it. The language was so startlingly modern. It talked about how God will take my feet out of the net. Now, I know that on one hand, there was a lot of allusion at that time to fishermen. But boy, isn't that what life is? Sometimes you feel your feet are caught in the net.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, it is the idea of a power greater than us. It could do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And that power is not outside us. It's inside us. And the problems in the world today are a consequence of the fact that we have so over-secularized the human outlook in our society. It is so devoid of reverence. We have a planet that's in trouble because of it's not just environmental policy, it's our irreverence towards the earth that led to those crazy environmental policies. You look at ISIL and you look at all the craziness that was caused because we invaded Iraq. Where were our hearts? Here, we were going to rain fire from the sky down on men, women, and children who had done nothing to us. Their country had nothing to do with 9/11. You say, well, they might have had weapons of mass destruction. This country does business, and we as citizens do business with countries with weapons of mass destruction every single day. Well, he killed people, his own citizens. You think the Chinese have it? We do business with them every day. What were we as people thinking, acquiescing so easily to something that was going to cause such pain for people who, you know, this wasn't the Nazis. This wasn't, you know, this. There was no deep moral argument made for that war.
I can't agree with you more. Absolutely. Absolutely. And the repercussions, of course, have been just devastating to us. And, you know,
And for them.
More for them in many ways, of course. Let me also say that, you know, you ran for Congress. I know politics is, you know, your thing, my thing. Let's talk a little bit about it, only because, you know, I had Stephen Dinan on the show the other day with his wonderful new book and this transpartisan movement. Let's get past the crap. But, you know, I said to Stephen, and I'm going to say it to you too, and I want to hear what you have to say. I think this, what's going on in our politics, really does get far more than the issues so much as it has to do with this lack of spirituality, this lack of love, this lack of recognizing our next door neighbor, our person, our politician as people, not just their ideas. It's so cruel out there. It's so ugly out there. What they're doing to Hillary is just vicious. Where is the damn love?
Well, also the irresponsibility that Paul Ryan would call for,
right?
Congressional hearings on that email situation, but not congressional hearings on what's going on with these police killings.
Unbelievable.
That's what they should be doing, congressional hearings.
That's good. But you hear what I'm saying. I mean, at the core of even our political problems is a lack of love. And, you know, we used to be peace, love, and understanding, and now we're that's gone.
Yes, but once again, there's one cancer underlying all these cancers, and that is the undue influence of money. When you have a market-based healthcare system and you have an investment more in selling drugs than in getting people well and getting people off the drugs, once again, the problem there is the short-term economic gain that is the bottom line. When you look at the undue influence of money on our politics, the fact that because of Citizens United, because of McCutcheon, we now have unlimited amount of money that flows into our political system, and it's turned our democracy into a handmaiden to these huge economic forces.
So
this is what happens when money, whether it's the money of the NRA or it's the money of the big pharma or the money of the fossil fuel industry or money of the military industrial complex or money of the chemical companies. So until we get the money out of politics, until we get the money driven issue out of big pharma, that's the underlying cancer in all of these situations. We can talk transpartisan all we want. The problem, you know, the problem isn't that people disagree. It's that they're not agreeing from the place of high-minded ideals. You know, President Eisenhower said that the American mind at its best is both liberal and conservative. I think that's true. You want people who are holding up high-minded conservative ideals, high-minded liberal ideas, high-minded progressive ideals, high-minded libertarian ideals. They're all part of the conversation. But too much today, particularly because both major political parties are so beholden to the moneyed interests that support them, we've got what we got. So we can talk about changing politics all we want and have a real flowery conversation about it. But until we get money out of all of this, it's the money that's driving politics that's the problem. It's the money that's driving our healthcare system that is the problem. And we need to wake up and look at that seriously as citizens.
I am so glad you said that, because I rail about this all the time. I mean, this Citizens United thing could be the end of us, I mean, as far as I'm concerned. And I don't know how we're going to get past it because...
We need a constitutional amendment,
right,
which will call for public funding of federal campaigns. That's
absolutely
the only ultimate answer.
Right.
And between the two political candidates right now, we have reached a point where it is very valid to say it's all about the Supreme Court. You have one candidate who would appoint Supreme Court justices who would theoretically be interested in overthrowing Citizens United, whereas you have another candidate who would be interested, if anything, in overthrowing, who would select Supreme Court justices who would not overthrow Citizens United, although they would theoretically overthrow Roe v. Wade. So it's a very disheartening presidential campaign.
Let's get back to the book before we close.
Great.
Because this is what I want to say to you. I told Marianne off air, this is maybe one of her most important books. So I'm telling all of you listeners, pick this one up, okay? This is so powerful. And she goes, you know, it's Marianne, so you know she goes off in tangents that are things that you all need to hear. So saying it's true, you and I are a lot alike that way. So saying all of that, I want to take it, go back to the spiritual a little bit. The title of the book is Tears to Triumph, The Spiritual Journey from Suffering to Enlightenment. Speak to me about enlightenment.
Enlightenment, you know, the Course in Miracles says that light is understanding. And it defines enlightenment as a shift in personal self-identification from body identification to spirit identification, to the extent to which we are attached, as Buddha would say, to the things of this world. To that extent, we cannot be happy. And the ego mind, which is the mind of attachment to the material world, says that we will become happy if we get more things of the material world, which only makes the screw in tighter and tighter and tighter. So enlightenment is where we are uplifted to a level of taking the material circumstances of life a little bit more lightly. And we are lifted in spirit, psychologically and emotionally, to a place where we are not so much at the effect of mortal circumstances. Now, forgiveness being a perfect example. If I am constantly focused on what you did to hurt me, then I will be at the effect of what you did to hurt me. Only by my willingness to free you from my focus on your guilt will I free myself from being at the effect of your guilt. And that is true of everything. If you only identify the meaning of your life and the reality of your life with what happens on the material plane, things change. Some days you get it right, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you got the job, sometimes you lost it. Sometimes you're in the money, sometimes you're not. Sometimes I love you, sometimes you're not. But you're constantly grasping, you're constantly struggling, you're constantly on the make to make it happen. This is a crazy way to live, and it's not a way that produces happiness. If, on the other hand, we wake up in the morning and we spend at least 5 minutes sending our love out into the world, praying to remember that today I am not a body, I am a being of love. I have a purpose on this earth, and that is to love. So you send your love before you to all the people you know you're going to meet today. You send your love before you to all the people you don't even know yet you're going to meet. You ask to be a vessel of love as a teacher, a vessel of love as a scientist, a vessel of love as a parent, a vessel of love as an artist, a vessel of love as a citizen. That is enlightenment. It is deliverance from our emotional suffering through the cultivation of infinite love and compassion. And it is the only way to happiness.
I've been speaking with Marianne Williamson, author of Tears to Triumph, The Spiritual Journey from Suffering to Enlightenment, by way of Harper One. For more information about Marianne Williamson and her work, visit her website at marianne.com. On Facebook, find her at Williamson Marianne, and on Twitter at Mar Williamson. You are listening to The Hallie Kester Jane Show. My guest today, Marianne Williamson, author of Tears to Triumph, and Susanna Andrews, Lisa Schifrin, Sheila Weller, and me, our panel of four broads talking. We'll be back in a minute. Stay with us. And we are back on the Hallie Kester Jane Show. Thank you for being here. Okay, folks, they're here. Here is this week's edition of Four Broads Talking. In case you don't remember from last week, our ladies, or broads, we go both ways, are Sheila Weller, Lisa Schifrin, Susanna Andrews, and me, Hallie Kester Jane. I'll be joining in as well as moderating. Okay, here we go. We're Four Broads Talking. And here we are, another segment of our Four Broads Talking. How do you like that voice today, guys? How do you like that, right? Yeah, I'm like down in the, I don't know where, my throat's killing me today. Joining me at my table this week is Vanity Fair writer Susanna Andrews. Say hi.
How are you? Hi. Great to be here.
It's great to have you here. Our gal writer, Sheila Weller.
Great to be here as well.
And our, what am I going to say, Lisa? Our resident conservative, Lisa Schifrin. Say hello, Lisa.
Hello, Lisa.
Hello, Hallie. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm out in my third world today. I don't know what the story is. Anyway, who am I? I am your host, Hallie Kester Jane. And I want to say again to everybody hello. And you know what? There's a lot going on, so let's get right to it. All right. So, as we go to tape today, first night of the DNC convention is now in the history books, but what a first day night. Oh, my gosh. So, here's my thing. Will I die if I say Debbie Wasserman Schultz? I mean, is that going to be make me toxic? Right?
No, say it.
I mean, I said it. I'm waiting for the gods to come and strike me down. So WikiLeaks exposes emails that show that the DNC favored Bernie Sanders, so to speak, and more. And Wasserman Schultz, who for 5 years led the DNC, is kryptonite. Suzanne Andrews, I'm going to throw this over to you because I know you got a lot to say, but I want you to do this. There are two stories here. Deal with the emails. Deal with WikiLeaks. Talk to me.
Well, we know now that, as everyone knows, 19,000 emails of the DNC were released by WikiLeaks on Friday, indicating the DNC wasn't giving Bernie Sanders a fair shake. What's interesting here is that immediately there was some speculation that's hardening that Russian hackers intruded into the computers. What I found so far is that, you know, it sounds like a science fiction, fantasy, conspiracy theory to many, but it's almost routine these days. Sort of the new frontier of political and corporate espionage. Cyberspace, State Department, White House, Joint Chiefs of Staff have all had intrusions from these same hackers linked to the GRU and the FSB, which are Russian secret services.
Very impressed by this, Susanna.
Again, I'm saying it's all speculation because it was only turned over to the FBI for investigation a couple days ago. But the hack took place at least in April when the DNC first discovered that their computers had been broken into and they hired a company to investigate. But there is some evidence that this, you know, their computers may have been rifled through for a year since last summer. What is new here is that everything was given to WikiLeaks, and I find the timing very interesting. Somebody had these emails, if we're to believe these investigators, somebody had these emails for months, but it's on the eve of the Democratic National Convention. They're handed to WikiLeaks, which puts them on their computers for the public to consume 19,000 really incriminating emails. So
there we are. So my question becomes this. Let me just ask you this. You say horribly incriminating. I've been arguing with people on Facebook about this. I bet you if they found this in the Democratic Party, if they did the same thing to the Republican Party, they probably find the same shenanigans going on. These are political people who have a...
I think so too, my dear.
I agree. I was putting horribly incriminating in quotes because I actually don't think that there's anything here that's of any surprise.
Right.
Really? Well, I don't. I think this is politics as usual, and I think that we would all love to read... No, we wouldn't. They'd be as boring, but the RNC's email traffic dealing with Donald Trump and trying to oust him from being the nominee.
I would like to interject.
Okay, Lisa, go and interject because I know you're biting and chomping at the bit. Go, darling.
First, let's not speculate about the RNC because I'm sure they're bad, but who knows? We don't know. This is about the DNC. Whoever released them, the DNC wrote them, and some of them are really kind of offensive. And they're offensive in ways that are precisely the ways that Democratic politicians go after the rest of society. You know, Taco Bowl outreach for Hispanics. What's worse for Bernie Sanders being a Jew or an atheist?
Wait, one second. Let her finish. Give her a little.
So, and the rigging the election. That's actually the word, rigging. And the reason that is not a surprise is that you've heard from both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. The reason the two of them did so well is that everybody understands that these parties are corrupt. And I say parties, both. The Democrats are caught here.
Well, that's what I said, Lisa, though. I'm going to stop you because that's exactly what I said. You can't say it's about one or the other. Let me bring Sheila in. Sheila, rigged?
I just wanted to say about the Bernie Sanders as a Jew. I'm a secular Jew. I didn't mind them saying that about him. I thought it was stupid and ham-handed. Why would the Democrats want to make a lack of quote-unquote religiosity or a lack of quote-unquote, I hate this word, faith, an issue to the Democrats? I didn't get that, so I thought that sounded like evangelicals talking. But I didn't think that was so awful. I just didn't. Period. So shoot me.
It's more divide and conquer. You know, are we gonna market him as a Jew or an atheist to these Southern Baptists who, I mean, it's kind of funny. And as a Jew, I think it's nice that they don't mind Jews, but they hate atheists. So that's what we want to do.
I think it's pretty benign.
I'm sorry, but I had a laugh at that one. But I want to say this. It did not change the fact that Hillary won over votes. None of this changed the results of anything. It's just major embarrassing. So I want to go there.
Well,
but
I do think there's an issue that, I mean, Lisa sort of slid by this and said the bigger story here was really the content of the emails, you know, not how they were brought forward. But I disagree. I think if indeed it is definitively sort of proved, and it's very difficult to do so in the hacking world, but if it is proved that the Russian state agents Democratic National Committee's emails and then deliberately turned around and fed them to an organization that would publicize them right before a major event in the U.S. election. I think that is major. I think that's new and serious. I think it's sort of the new look in the Cold War.
Nobody wants to see the Russians meddling in our elections. I'd like to actually reframe something you said, Susanna. You pointed out that these same hackers have also been blamed for hacking the State Department, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the White House, a bunch of places, a bunch of serious intelligence, important bureaucracies in the Obama administration. This is, among other things, this suggests a certain amount of carelessness.
I didn't say they hacked them. I said there were signs that they had intruded.
Well, as we went, Let me interrupt for a second. Wait. We're talking, a story did just break on the Daily Beast that it was definitely Russian hackers. Definitively. So let's get that in there. That the guy who said he was something else was not. He was Russian. He was definitely goes to Putin's office. But I don't want to go too far out on this because we've got a lot to talk about today. But I do want to say this. Lisa, how about this? You and I both got upset when we found out that Obama had tried to influence the Netanyahu campaign.
That's right. No, I'm not.
So this is not something that is acceptable at all by any government. That's my position.
Of course, except that it happens all the time.
Well, it does.
Especially if you are
not the release. Like, the release is the release.
The release is really disgusting. You're right about that.
The release is interesting because I've learned that.
One at a time.
Something I learned that I didn't know is that WikiLeaks is considered by everyone now just a Russian front, a front for.
Right.
No, that's a very right-wing view of WikiLeaks, just to put it in context.
Okay. So let's leave it there for now. I think there's going to be more to this story. I want to move on, okay?
Yeah.
And I'm
all
in control.
Right.
So we're moving on.
Injustice.
Okay. Here's the next person I want to talk. I want to talk about Bernie. Here's my issue with Bernie. I thought he has not done the job that I feel he should do to bring his people around. Even today, there's some kind of nonsense going on where he's not quite willing to say, stop it. And jump on board. They were trying to cut a deal with him today that he would actually help with the introduction and the vote, you know, to bring Hillary, you know, home. And it looks to me that he's at this point said no. I watched him earlier in the day yesterday talking to his people. He's non-definitive. He was a little better last night, but I think he did a half-ass job. Sheila, let me talk to Sheila. Sheila hasn't had a lot to say.
I thought it was Bernie's night last night. I mean, everybody else loves Michelle's speech, and there's a lot to say about it. I thought the power of Bernie really came through. I just thought he was the star of last night. Is he doing enough? For months and months, I said he's not doing enough. My husband and I every day said he's not doing enough. We're mad at Bernie. We're mad at Bernie. We started out liking him. We're mad at him. People have said, maybe Susanna, you're one of them. He can't. Oh, I know, Selma Adams. Other people have said he can't bring you. He is a figurehead, but the movement is a movement on its own. So I don't know if he can. He probably can do more. It was a little half-assed last night. But,
I agree that he can't do more. I mean, his people are very angry, and he kind of sold out. And you might call that adult politics and compromise, and he did lose. And I would say that, too. But I think that people who want to join this kind of movement that's always very idealistic and principled, this is about principles from the point of view of certainly the young people in this movement, it is very hard to turn around after getting them all riled up and say, no, I didn't mean any of what I said about Hillary being corrupt and being the establishment and being unfit to be president. Now I'm endorsing her. There's only so far you can go with
it. See, I disagree with that. And one of the reasons that I disagree with that is because I think that in a way this is not a movement. It's a cult. It's young people being manipulated to a certain degree. And I felt that way only after he wouldn't let go and he wouldn't concede and he played it. Susanna, you got something on this?
You know, I think with Bernie, the trajectory is interesting. He started out as a very different candidate. He wasn't insulting Hillary. He went out of his way not to insult Hillary. He wanted to just talk about the issues. And then suddenly, as he got, you know, started to get more support, I think, than he anticipated, I think his ego sort of took over, and it transformed itself into, I agree with Hallie, it's almost like a cult-like political movement. About last night, he gave the same speech that he's been giving now for a year, almost verbatim. One thing that he said, and I wanted to actually ask you all and throw it out because it's the one thing I tripped over. He said something to the effect of, I am looking forward to your votes at the roll call tomorrow night. In other words, He was going to make the convention go through the whole roll call, not conceded.
Well, that's what they've been arguing about today. That's what I was referring to. So I don't know where they are on that.
I didn't think that to me, I thought, you know, he knows he's not in control of his own movement. He knows that he can't control them. So why, you know, sort of risk that moment where he publicly is seen not to be in charge?
Or on the other side of it is maybe he doesn't want to control them.
But I would say that it's directly analogous to the position Ted Cruz found himself in.
Right. That's
and
true.
And he did the other thing. You know, he said, no, I'm going to stick to principle. And many, many people, and I'm a big Ted Cruz supporter, but many people, including me, think he did the wrong thing, which may be because I'm old and I think that sooner or later you just get, you know, this is politics. It's not philosophy.
Did the wrong thing by going to the convention and not endorsing?
Well, I think either you go and endorse, however half-heartedly or with whatever kind of code you want, and you bring in your personal brand of politics. Bernie, socialism, Cruz, constitutionalism, whatever.
It's the right thing to do when it's the way politics should be played. But let's not spend a lot of time on that because that's yesterday's news. So here we are. Let's move to Michelle. Oh, my gosh. What a surprise. Sheila and Hallie and maybe Susanna share something in common. You guys let me do this so that we can get it out there quickly, which is none of us were great fans of hers early on.
You and I weren't. I think everybody else was.
I don't know. Susanna, I got the feeling you
I'm
had...
I'm with you all. I'm
yeah.
with you all.
Me,
I was
me
very
too.
Okay. And actually, I felt that she's been kind of not the greatest first lady. She hasn't been up and out front as much as some other first ladies have. Maybe she has to her community, and we don't know that. We don't see it. But that's been my assessment of her. She shocked me last night. I absolutely went, wow. She grew up. She's not angry anymore. She has evolved into quite a wonderful woman. I loved her. I'm going to throw it to Sheila because I don't think, Sheila, you're getting your fair share of time here.
Okay.
Yeah, bad at baby girl.
Yeah, I at the beginning didn't like the fact that he loved her so much. I really think he threw that debate in the last election because he wanted to be there with her on their anniversary. There was a little bit of, I like that you scold me that you say you have to come home for 6:30 dinner. There's something about the dynamic. Presidents who love their wives too much, men who love their wives too much and love being scolded, I'm not crazy about that. And I got that vibe from her at the beginning. So I wasn't the biggest fan of hers. I saw her in person at the Apollo Theater about 10 months ago at a glamour event with her and others. And I saw the fabulous charm of her for the first time. And last night I saw it again. Frankly, I wasn't as knocked out by the speeches as everybody else in the world was, so I think I'm just an outlier here. I thought it was a really good speech. The parts of it that I liked the best was her saying, Hillary took the knock. Hillary took it when they put her down for this, that, and the other thing. I wasn't crazy about the part of the speech where she talked about, you know, this is a house the slaves built, my two black daughters. I didn't like her going into race. I'm sorry, I just didn't. I think everything else about the speech was fabulous, and everybody else thought it was fabulous.
Lisa Schifrin, what do you think?
Well, I never liked Michelle. I thought she got to this, you know, to the most privileged spot in the land for the spouse of a politician, elected by the American people, which is to say, this, you know, despite or because or for whatever reason, knowing that they were black. We didn't just find that out when they got there. And she was resentful, and she always appeared kind of irritated to have to deal with the public. I also thought that she came across very, very differently last night. She came across, I agree with you, Hallie, as more mature and more gracious. She delivered a beautiful speech on behalf of a woman she is known to dislike very intensely. They've never had dinner. You know, she does not like Hillary or Bill, and the two couples never, ever socialize. So I thought that was a great piece of political work. As a speechwriter, I say this like day in, day out these days. It was a speech. Somebody wrote it for her. The sentiments, she delivered them beautifully, but you really don't necessarily want to ascribe all that much to them. The part about her seeming more gracious about she's watched her daughters grow up, I think that maybe you're more worried when you walk in and your little kids are, you know, subjected to the media. And her daughters have done just fine, and she's done just fine. You know, I do think that there's this unfortunate tendency now that if a first lady does well, to think about a career for her in politics.
Well,
I think
that's
she should
absurd.
Go up and find something that she
Yeah, likes. Let that one go. Susanna, you got something on this?
No, I I think the most powerful part of her speech was, I thought the cleverest thing was to reframe the debate over leadership of this country in terms of, what do you want your children to see? Now, for all those millions of people who don't have children, maybe you felt momentarily left out, but it was very effective and very powerful way of saying, look at Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton through a different lens for a moment, and which one passes this.
Yeah, I thought it was brilliant. And let me interject this, because again, I'm going to shut this part of the conversation down because I think we have to move on. But for you, Lisa, I will say this. I'm comparing the introduction of Hillary to Ivanka introducing her dad, and it's a weird comparison.
It is a weird comparison because Michelle is a grown-up woman who was, you know, we see her standing on her own in the world, and she's held a very powerful position in politics for 8 years. And Ivanka Trump is a, I don't know, 35-year-old young mother of three she's brand new to politics. She's talking about her daddy, and she did a beautiful job too, by the way. But, you know, one of these people is a national figure, and one is,
well, I guess the reason I bring it up is because I think I see a difference between the way the two conventions are being run. And I think that's maybe a topic for conversation. Even if we don't answer that, I think that it's something that should be put out there, because I think it says a lot about where the two parties are right now. Sheila, real quick, anything there?
Well, I thought last week's was a very dark convention. I mean, I don't think I'm the only Democrat that felt that way. I thought last night started out with, you know, oh, my God, this is Debbie Wasserman Schultz thing with the Bernie fanatics. This is going to be horrible. And as the evening went on, it became pretty terrific. A speaker after speaker raised the excitement level, and there was not a kumbaya thing, but there was excitement. There was star power there. There were good ideas put forth. There was a sense of, this is what the Democratic Party was. I thought it was a great night. I thought it ended up being so much better than it started out, and I think a lot of the pundits felt that way as well.
Susanna, there were no American flags to be seen anywhere, and there was no mention of ISIS. What?
It was the first night, and I think it was the night, and as Sheila put it, the night, it was Bernie's night. It was night to deal with that issue. It was night to deal with the huge sort of elephant in the middle of the room, this division in the party. I think ISIS will definitely come up. I think guns will definitely come up. They kill more people in the United States than terrorism. But I think that the Democrats have organized their convention very well. I think we're going to see themes each night. And the Republicans did that, too.
They just didn't follow through. Yeah.
The flags, you know.
That is weird.
We are going to see them. But I think the Republican Party has co-opted those symbols of patriotism to such an extent that
Let me just ease up for a moment.
Hold it, Lisa.
If we just needed to ease up on the first night, they'll be there. I know they'll be there. I'm pretty sure. We should put some money on it. Let's put some money on it.
Can I just say, right? I'm going to say this before Lisa says anything. I hated the set. I thought it was cold and weird. Lisa, talk.
I didn't like the stage design either, but the fact is these convention halls are big and cold, and there's only so much you can do with them. Bunting and flags would have been fine. It's obviously not. You can't say that one party co-opts them just because they use them and the other party doesn't use them. If the Democrats had put up flags, they would have been their flags. It would have conveyed the same patriotism. And you know, here's the deal. Last night, I heard more Democrats, especially Democrats who are known for their harsh critiques of aspects of our politics and our society, tell us how great America was and how thrilled they are with it. And I just thought that was the funniest thing, because the only reason they're doing that is because Donald Trump is saying America needs to be made great again.
Wait a minute. Yes, I am jumping in on that. How about America is great, Lisa? Maybe that's the problem. Wait a minute. Maybe that's the problem. Maybe that is, yeah, a lot of people have a problem with the Republican Party, and it hasn't been winning elections. Maybe because it's coming from the negative. Maybe because it's always looking at the bad. You know, the one thing I walked away with last night, and I have a feeling Sheila and Susanna, you may agree with me on this, is I actually felt good. I actually went to sleep afterward. I actually felt, wow, you know, there's something positive. I am so tired of hearing all the negativity and this, that, and the other thing.
I felt it too. I did. Yeah.
Let me just say, yes, I agree that that is a real contrast, and it's there for a reason. Any out party has to criticize the in party to make their case for change?
I don't know. I think maybe if I were the out party, I would change the way that I was doing it, because the way that they've been doing it, they haven't won the major elections. They win, you know, this little... think about that. Maybe it's time for the Republican Party to not be so dark.
Okay. If you want to win the presidency, you kind of have to make a case. And I think Hillary's going to have a really hard case to make, saying that everything's so great after 8 years of Democrat rule with these same policies, given that the reality is that wages are down, people...
Susanna, feel free to jump in.
And our foreign policy is a huge mess. So I think the negative reflects reality in some real way, even though we don't like hearing
I think that Elizabeth Warren touched on that in a very direct way. I think she was married the two. You know, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We can say America is great, and we can also say, you know, there's a lot of room for improvement. Cory Booker touched that theme by saying, we are working on forming a more perfect union. It's an ongoing job. You know, and I think the way that Elizabeth Warren, you know, you present the problems out there in a positive way by saying, you know, we are going to present you policies that will help to, you know, alleviate these problems. I also wanted to say about the two conventions, the Republican convention seemed to be very much about one man, and you could really see that the party was a little bit, you know, stilting, you know, a little ungenerous with its support because, every, you know, all his children had to fill in and this. But last night it was just rambunctious, and there were people from every walk, and you had musicians and singers and so many, you know, sort of major party figures lining up to speak. I got a feeling of just more openness, more of a community, sounding that community scene.
Well, what you got is the people, it's the people's party.
Well, also, Hillary was the establishment candidate, and so people are not unhappy, except for the 40% of Bernie supporters.
Well, now they're saying 90%. Wait, let me throw that in. Wait a minute. You threw something out. 90% of his voters apparently are now throwing their vote to Hillary. 90%. That was what I heard right before we went on air. So go ahead.
You know, the Republicans, it's not a secret that we had a contentious primary and that Donald Trump was not everybody's cup of tea. What is more interesting...
But the leadership of the party was absent at the Republican convention.
No, the leadership of the party was there. The former presidents were absent, but that, I think, has a lot to do with pissing matches between various Bushes and Donald Trump. And
Romney wasn't
there.
Well, nobody was there, really. That's why five of his kids had to be the ones to be the
you know,
keynote speakers.
Romney lost an election because he didn't say a bunch of things that needed to be said.
Well, that was yesterday's news. Let's not beat him up anymore. Let's have some fun, though. Let's talk this. Let's talk somebody.
I love Bridge Over Troubled Water.
I was just going to go there, honey. You're reading my mind.
Okay. Can I just say this?
Yes, you can.
Like, wiping my eyes, but what I noticed, and you had people who weren't born when that song was first a hit, and you had people who as old as their grandparents in the audience, and they were all sort of mouthing the lyrics. It is one of those great American ballads, and there were tears in the audience, and I got out my Kleenex.
I don't think she's alive. I know his mom. And
Simon?
Yeah.
That'll do it, right?
Well, no, it freaked me out how much she looks like her in old age. It freaked me out. I almost thought for a minute it was she walking up on the stage. But I was so glad that he did that because he said he may not want to sing anymore. Sheila, what'd you want to say?
Well, yeah, his voice wasn't great. I've heard him say he may not sing anymore. I know Bob Hilburn is doing his biography, which is great. It's going to be a great story. He's a wonderful songwriter. That and the American song, I mean, you know, he didn't sound terrific singing it, but it's a major, major song.
Okay, let me bring up another Hollywood name. Susan Sarandon was there, and they cut to her, and she had this pouty, mean, didn't even look attractive look on her face. Did anybody catch it?
I didn't, but she's a big Bernie supporter.
Yeah, she's not a happy camper. She was sitting there going, pout, 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 pout. And then
I was surprised that she was there, actually.
Yeah.
She boycotted, you know.
No, she didn't boycott it. But how about that Sarah Silverman? How about that Al Franken? How about those two?
I say about Sarah Silverman?
Yes, ma'am.
I want her plastic surgeon. She looks fabulous. She was attractive before. Now she's a beauty.
Or maybe she's just like other Jewish girls. We always get better in old age.
I want her plastic surgeon.
I want her plastic surgeon. She looks like she's very happy right now. That's what it is.
Yeah.
And she hasn't looked that happy in a long, long time. But that's a funny girl. And she took a risk with opening her mouth. Can I throw in Cory Booker? You all asked me on Facebook who I thought should have or could have been a good vice presidential candidate. And I thought he could. And he got dwarfed last night. If he had just been him and Michelle hadn't followed, everybody would have been talking about him last night.
I'm going to tell you something funny. My conservative friends and I spent a lot of time talking about him because he's really smart and he's really interesting. He has a terrible, terrible record of achieving nothing in Newark, but he is charming. He's a good-looking man. He has a great smile. He has beautiful delivery. He has a first-rate education. He's obviously intelligent. You know, he's the guy that he's a natural.
He really is. He really is.
Except I think calling for love in politics is just always a little hokey.
I thought he was being snarky. I don't think he was being hokey at all.
Oh,
he was
no,
being...
I think he really meant it.
No, no. When he answered Trump today, he said, I'm just going to love him. That was snark.
I thought he was good. I thought they all rolled up. I thought Elizabeth Warren, I mean, I thought it was a star-studded evening. I mean, I didn't think he was overshadowed. You know, I just thought that once it got going, it really got going. The physically disabled person was the least interesting. Isn't that a terrible thing to say?
No, no. The woman who lost all her money to Trump University.
Oh, that was weird. That was a little weird.
Oh, I liked her.
Oh, no, the video was good. But why did they drag her up to repeat herself?
Yeah, I thought that was weird. But the other thing is that they may have violated some laws by having the illegal immigrants on the stage. I don't know if anybody's going to prosecute.
I think that's a funny move. We've seen it before. It's always about some kid whining about being an illegal and living in the shadows.
No, even whining. I don't like that. That was nasty. That was nasty. Don't say whining. There's a young kid who's scared to death. Her parents are going to be taken away from her. That's not whining.
In the middle of the Democratic National Convention, she's not going to be taken anywhere. It's meant to play on heartstrings. And really, I think that does nothing other than encourage the anti-immigrant sentiment and the build a wall thing. It's like, you know, you're here illegally and you're afraid that you're breaking a law and you might be snatched. Okay, there are some solutions.
Yeah, Miss Republican Bush.
No, I'm going to agree with Lisa on this. I'm going to agree. I think that, you know, there's a tendency in the debate currently to each side to completely dismiss the other side and to paint them in the darkest possible terms. And I think one thing that is being done by the Democratic Party right now is to say, you know, if you have any questions as to whether we should be enforcing our immigration laws, you are inhuman, insensitive, an ogre, and, you know, a nasty un-American person. And I think it's a legitimate question to ask.
I agree with you.
Do we want to have immigration laws? And if so, do we want to enforce them?
Well,
or
obviously.
Do we want an open border? Is that what they're saying?
Well, if you want to go on the topic itself, on whether or not we should or we shouldn't, I'd be interested to hear what everybody said. I mean, to have an open border is an insanity, and we all know that. What to do about the problem right now, that's something else. Sheila, you got something on that?
Well, I'm with Susanna on that. I think that both parties have seen the complaint is wages have gone down for white working class, that others, you know, coming in from other countries are taking jobs. I think that's legitimate. I think Susanna's right about the immigration thing. I'm in favor of the Dream Act and all of that. I've done articles on, you know, sweatshop workers in L.A. felt very sympathetic toward them. But I get that. I get that, you know, that isn't a top priority for me. And I think that Susanna's point was right.
I also think Lisa's point was right. Was you're taking, wait, what was this little girl symbolizing? You know, it's that whole debate people are having, and it's sort of saying, you know what, we have laws, but if you break them, you'll be rewarded because you have put yourself in an extremely dicey, dangerous position. And we really need to have a debate, an honest debate in this nation, not this name-calling and polarizing.
Well,
so
sure.
I'm finding myself agreeing with Lisa.
Well, no, I think we're on the same page on this one. And here's what's interesting about it. You know the other thing that they do? Like at the State of the Union, they always pull in these people who sit next to the First Lady, and then they say, and that makes me nuts.
Right, it's time for that to end.
Yeah, right. That's the same thing as that woman being up screaming.
Can I say something?
Wait, let me finish what I was going to say. That's the same thing as being the mother of the kid who was killed in Benghazi. It's using people. It's taking advantage of their pathetic whatever. But yeah, go ahead.
This is dangerous for me to say because I'm a Democrat and I'm a supporter of Hillary. But John and I both said, why is Cecile Richards looking really attractive with that attractive dress sitting right next to Bill Clinton? Those optics were not good.
Wait! I didn't realize that was Richards.
The Planned Parenthood, but Bill Clinton didn't have to be sitting next to an attractive woman.
Gorgeous woman.
I mean, okay,
oh, she's fabulous. Can you believe it's her? She's the daughter of.
You're so right. The optics were a little disconcerting.
I didn't realize that's who it was. I didn't have my glasses on. That's fascinating. That's great. Well, let's see how he's going to do tonight. I can't wait to talk about that.
Ann Richards.
She's the head of Planned Parenthood, and she's. Ann Richards,
she's
and she's Ann Richards' daughter, and she's absolutely exquisite. She's
the
really
optics were bad, and they're not going to be so great when she gets up to give a speech either, because abortion, like immigration, is a topic where you can be for something and not think that it's a great thing that is worthy of celebration, but a kind of maybe a necessary evil, and the Democrats have moved on from that. So
I don't get what you're saying. Did you guys get what she was saying? What are you saying?
Well, I think the new position is, well, we've got Tim Kaine, the vice presidential candidate, whose position has been the old Mario Cuomo. I'm a Catholic. I'm personally opposed to abortion, but it should be safe.
And he'll have no weight in the party on that. They will squash him. I'm sure a deal was made. Shut up and don't talk about it. I'm sure.
Most pro-choice people, and I am definitely one, are fine with his position. He's not going to get in the way of anything.
Right. He's not. Exactly. He's always said.
People our age, I think for young women, you know, that Katha Pollitt wrote a piece a couple of years ago. That
I know. Yeah.
But how we should celebrate this. Why should abortion be rare? Why should we pretend we're sorry?
I think that was really, I was very on the other side of her piece, but I didn't want to be public about it.
Right.
Lots of young
Well, now you are.
I am.
You are. All right. I hate to do this, but we got to wrap. So here we are. We're at the end of another quick 30-something minutes. Oh, my God, gals, you are so smart, and you're so funny, and you're so right on the topic. Let's just like kind of close it down. Sheila, you got something for us as we say goodnight?
Well, I was going to say I love Sarah Silverman's new look, so I can't think of anything else other than I hope the convention keeps getting better because it was a lot of fun last night, and it's taking my mind off unpleasant things. So keep rolling, Democrats.
Susanna?
I want to say that we are, just to remind us all, whatever you feel about Hillary Clinton, lover, hater, this is a truly historic moment. It is really big. This is the first woman about to be nominated as candidate by a major party for the presidency of the United States of America. And for a certain generation of women, this is really a major achievement. And I've had the long Hillary Clinton journey. Loved her, hated her. You know, I don't think she's corrupt, but I don't like, you know, 90. Lisa and I would agree on a lot of things, but I am with her. I am awed and pleased to be around for this historical juncture.
Lisa?
Yeah, I think it's great for our daughters to see that level of success is normal for women. I personally much prefer the aesthetic in England, where they just elected their second female conservative prime minister without all of this gender reference and identity politics. I think that's a far superior way to do it, based it on merit. Hillary, if Hillary wasn't the wife of an ex-president, I'd be much more impressed.
Oh, my gosh. I'm not even going to go there. Oh, my. Yes, I am going to go there. Are you kidding me?
No.
Are you kidding me? First of all, he probably would never have gotten himself elected if he didn't have her brains behind him. He had the style. She had the brains.
Were the candidate?
What? I didn't hear you because you were talking on top of me. What?
Sorry. Elizabeth Warren were the candidate. There's a woman who, as she told us, came from nothing, did it all herself. I don't even know who her husband is or what he does.
Well, with all due respect, Hillary came from nothing and she did it herself.
She did it. It builds presidency, too.
Right. Exactly what I'm trying to say. That's where I'm going. Well, listen, on that hot note, let's leave that and let's do this. Let's pick off where we left next week for our Broad Talking.
Great week, ladies.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun.
Bye-bye. Up next on the Hallie Kester Jane Show, from Olympian to call girl, the shocking and inspiring story of Susie Favor Hamilton, a show I promise you do not want to miss. See you there. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Kester Jane Show, a production of RESAC LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit HallieKesterJane.com.